Hey everyone, this is James LaBrie from Dream Theater, and you're listening to Prog Rock Digital.
Welcome to Prog Rock Digital. Hi everyone and welcome back to another episode of Prog Rock Digital. This is episode 10 of season 2. Thank you very much for downloading and streaming. Thank you for visiting progrockdigital.com and please keep those emails coming through. Now, today I am chatting with Prog Rock Records founder and owner, Sean Gordon. Now, the label is no longer in operation. However, the impact that Sean Gordon had on the prog rock scene, not only in the US, but worldwide, is quite astounding. Now, we also chat about the, a main project that was released in the early 2000s, and that was Frameshift. Now, there were two albums, and the first album was with guest vocalist James LaBrie, which I've had on the show before, and we all know is the vocalist in Dream Theater. The second album, however, and Sean gets into this in quite some detail, second album was recorded by guest vocalist being Sebastian Bach, the former Skid Row vocalist. We're back just after this quick break. Open
to fire. Paris of Troy out the Ludos Records, their debut single, Torn Away. Australian prog at its best. Available for download and stream on all digital platforms.
ParisofTroy.com.
My eyes are torn away.
Hello, this is Mick Box of Uriah Heep, and you're listening to Prog Rock Digital.
The man behind some of the most iconic pieces of art connected to some of the biggest names in rock. Ioannis. Originally from Athens, Greece, in the last 36 years has created over 300 record covers for such clients as King Crimson, Fate's Warning, Uriah Heep, Allman Brothers, Blue Oyster Cult, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Yngwie Malmsteen, Deep Purple, Styx, just to name a few. Be sure to connect with Ioannis at www.dangerousage.com.
Coming July 30th, the re-release of Amarin's Plight, Voice in the Light, featuring Gary Werkamp, DC Cooper, and Nick DiVigilio.
One of the greatest progressive conceptual albums of the 2000s is with us once again.
www.amarinsplight.net.
Out through Lone Wolf Music.
Falsett have released their debut album, We Follow or Lead the Way. Available for download and stream, visit falsett.co.
Sean Gordon, welcome to Prog Rock Digital. It's great to have you on the show. How are you, man?
Well, I watch entirely too much Australian television, so I pick it up a bit. My son's been there for 5.5 years now.
Well, Sean, look, that leads me to my first question. I've known you for about 20 years now. I know that you've lived in Australia. I mean, you're dialing in from California now, but you've lived in Australia. When did you move to Australia and why? Why Australia?
Yeah, I was in Melton. Weren't you guys in Melton?
No, so I'm about 15 kilometres from the Melbourne CBD, about an hour and a half from Melton.
Well, for a big country, that's pretty close to where I was. I was actually about a half hour or outside of Melton on a sheep ranch in the middle of nowhere. So let's see, when did I move there? It was 1982. And sort of a weird story. I'll relay it quickly. My dad invented this trampoline game called highball and then later called aeroball. And the guy who wanted the Australian license for it flew out here and was staying at my dad's house. And I was 18. I just graduated high school about 8 months before. And I was just visiting over at my dad's. And this guy, Roger Anthony, was there. And So I meet him, and he's like, "Oh, good day, Sean. How you doing?" And I'm like, "Great." And shortly after, he was a born again Christian. He's like, "You know, God just told me to ask you to come and stay with us in Australia." I'm like, "Well, that seems rather odd." So I kind of blew it off. I mean, I was going to college and I had a girlfriend, I was in a band and stuff. And strangely, I don't know how religious you are, but
I'm not that religious, no.
Okay. So the story of Jonah and the whale, you know, the whale swallowed Jonah because God kept telling him, you know, "Jonah, I really want you to do this now." And he's like, "Nah, it'll be all right." And so basically, he didn't have to do what God was asking him to, but his life was going to suck if he didn't. And so suddenly everything in my life went to hell. My girlfriend broke up with me, band broke up, things were all wrong, and everything that was keeping me from going. And so I said, "Oh, you know what? I guess I'll go." So I decided to go, and everything turned back to normal. So I said, "No, I'm going to stay." And everything went to shit again. And I'm like, "Oh, I guess I'll just go." you know, however you want to term that, that's why I went. And so I went and I helped with my dad's stuff while I stayed on these guys' ranch. And it was an interesting experience. And, you know, it's more fun to talk about than to have actually lived it, because we were in the middle of nowhere and we were having to hand feed lambs because there'd been a drought going on and the ewes were dropping lambs and not producing milk. So they're all dying. And they had just brought 50, 60 lambs in like the day before I got there. And so we had to mix up this formula, like in these 2-liter Coke bottles, and put nipples on them and hand feed these things 4 times a day. And, you know, every day you go out and more of them would be dead from, you know, laying on top of each other and pissing. So we had a big incinerator back there. We'd have to throw them into, to burn them, you know, so the beasties didn't come and dig them up or something.
Well,
so
that's crazy, man. How, where does this prog rock records come into play here? I mean, we're talking now, and let's fast forward to, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. You've started prog rock records. Why? I mean, what was the motivation or the inspiration to start something that would ultimately be, you know, one of the biggest names in prog?
So I'm a software guy. I have been since I was in high school, you know, back in the 70s. I started writing code. And I had decided in the late 90s, like 98, I was doing a lot of Y2K work. And I decided to start a software company. So when I finished up with these contracts after, you know, Y2K came and went, which, by the way, everything was going to break, but a lot of people worked their asses off to keep it from breaking. So, and I was one of those. So I started a software company, and I had the idea to do developer and desktop tools for Linux operating system initially. And yeah, I formed a corporation in 99 and got things rolling while I was doing the other thing. And so ended up, you know, broadening my scope, and, you know, we did it for Windows, Linux, and Mac. We also ended up doing a bunch of mobile or embedded software. Smartphones weren't out yet, but, you know, I bootstrapped it. I ended up putting out like 65, both digital distribution and shrink wrap products across 5 different platforms around the world. I mean, we were even in shops in New Zealand I'd set up. So, I had like, you know, 30 or so guys working for me. Like I said, completely bootstrapped. Everybody, this is the dot-com boom, but I didn't go and raise any money, which was why we survived so much longer than everybody else. So, you know, we had built all of our own credit card authorization integrations to the banks. None of those things existed at the time. And, you know, our own shopping cart and digital download system and all of this kind of stuff we built internally. So at the same time, I had, you know, I'd been interested in internet radio, and there was a number of them out there, and I really liked progrock.com. And I see one day the guy just wants to dump it. So I contact him, and that was Jerry George. And I think I gave him like $100-$200 for the name. And I took over the station. He kind of stayed on. And this was during 2000, I think early 2000. And so what I found was I was getting a lot of interesting material. No, it must have been in 99. Anyway, a lot of interesting material from unsigned artists. I'm like, you know what? There's a lot of good stuff out here. And I thought, you know what? I've already built all the software to do all of these things, right? You know, sales, distribution, I have distribution channels. I know how to shrink wrap and ship things. I know how to, you know, do shopping carts and, you know, all of that. So I thought, well, a logical extension of prog rock radio was prog rock records. And that was what we called it. And so I originally, one of the first few people I got was, so Little Atlas was one, and then Henning Pauly turned out to be about a 90-minute drive from me. And he came over and he played me this chain stuff. And I was working on a pitch for a Saga tribute album. And I had this idea for a version of Hot to Cold that I wanted to do. And I explained it to Henning. And I swear to God, a week later, he sends me like a complete version of the music. I'm like, okay, well, I didn't get to do it. He did what I said I wanted to do, which led to a, you know, a long and fruitful partnership. So then I had the idea of how I wanted to do it vocally, and I was able to. Interestingly, I was able to get a hold of Michael Sadler, who, you know, just lived like a couple hours away, and, you know, he's awesome. And Jerry George, who knew James LaBrie from Frameshift or from Dream Theater, said, hey, you know, I know James LaBrie. And he said, if anything interesting ever comes my way, to let him know. So Henning and I were talking about that, and he was a big, big Dream Theater fan. And he'd had this idea for this project called Baby Steps, which we ended up putting out eventually as well, which Sadler and LaBrie are both on, as well as some other vocalists. So we kind of made this pitch to James. And then as Henning was working on the music, he was like, you know what? I want to go a different direction. I want to do this other thing. And that was how he came up with Frameshift and the writings of Richard Dawkins. And so he and I kind of went back and forth on how to do it. And obviously I had very little to do with the music. I played a solo on one song. Excuse me. It's towards the end of my day. I've been talking half the day.
No problem.
So we got James. You know, it's just one of these weird things. Because originally I was thinking, okay, I'm never going to have more than 15 albums. And I'm going to keep it small, but I had just done the first few, then I had James. And so now I need, because, you know, that costs real money. I needed to have real distribution. And so that's when I had to really step it up. And then, you know, it just sort of got me insane. And I put out like 150 albums or something.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I know that you had signed a lot of bands. You've just said 150 or so releases, but the amount of bands A through Z, you know, on your website, you just had page after page of bands. How did you manage that logistically? I mean, that's a lot to manage.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was running my record label at the same time, or my software company at the same time. And I was doing virtually all of it myself. And then I hired an old friend of mine as a bookkeeper to at least track royalties, which are a freaking nightmare. Everybody pays at different rates and at different times. And sometimes they'll just pay you. And sometimes they just send you reports and they want you to invoice them. And that's how they drag out paying you. And then they have, they withhold for potential chargebacks. So yeah, you get an artist and like, you said we sold 100, I should have X dollars. Like, it ain't that simple, buddy. And we barely charged, you know, the only thing we really charged for was actual shipping costs for promo units. You know, I was not charging anybody for my time or storage or, you know, any of these other things.
So just to...
Yeah, it was yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, man. Yeah, no, look, I was just going to ask. So up until the first Frameshift album, how many bands had you been working with? Because obviously Frameshift, the release was fairly early in the prog rock era.
Yeah, Frameshift was probably... Now, keep in mind, we got together, I think, initially maybe in April of that year. So I kind of kicked off maybe December of that year. And then, you know, put out the first few things. You know, it was really just on my website. And I think we were on the Ghostland website and kind of just getting the word out and getting out in the community and such. And so that album didn't finally come out at retail until November. And then it ended up that there was a issue with Dream Theater because Train of Thought was going to come out like the same week. So they asked me to...
Yes, that's right. Because I do recall there being a slight delay and reading up on that as well.
Right. Yeah, they asked me to put it off. So then that put us into the holidays and we kind of missed a lot of... You know, because everything's a push for Christmas. And those initial, but the pre-orders out of Amazon just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, initially it was like 20. And I think by the time we shipped, I had like 600 or something, which sounds small, but, you know, we hadn't done anything really.
Well, yeah, look, it would have been mighty exciting though. I mean, you know, it's a startup sort of label at that stage anyway, for a better word. You know, you would, manufacturing, pressing, doing all the marketing yourself for the band and label.
Yeah, so I was doing all the marketing. I was writing all the press materials. I was putting everything out everywhere. I was getting into every watering hole for prog rock that I could find to integrate with or interact with the community. And, you know, because you want to be a part of the community. You don't want to be a drive-by salesman that just shows up to do stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And look, we've had heaps of labels that have gone about their business that way, unfortunately. So yeah, you weren't one of them, I'm happy to say. So Sean, the second Frameshift album, An Absence of Empathy, you enlisted the vocalist Sebastian Bach, whom we know, you know, former Skid Row vocalist. How did you manage to get Sebastian onto the project and recording? You know, how was it working with Sebastian? I'm sure you've got some interesting stories on that.
I had wanted Jeff Tate for it, and James LaBrie gave me Tate's, or put me in touch with Tate, and I talked to him a couple of times, and he was down for it, and I really like Jeff Tate a lot. And Henning started working on the music, and he's like, you know what? This stuff is heavier than I think would be good for Tate. And he's like, I really like Sebastian Bach for this. And I'm like, you know, I was never really a big Skid Row fan. I thought he was more of a screamer. I didn't really see the advantage to him over Tate, frankly. But there were stories about Tate and he could be difficult and with his wife and all that. And so there was also stories about Bach, or what do we call him, Baz?
Yeah, Baz. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it turned out LaBrie knew him too, and he put us in touch. So, yeah, he really liked the music, and we got him out. And when Baz is having a good time, everybody's having a good time. Unfortunately, at least at the time, maybe he's better now, he was essentially emotionally arrested as a 15-year-old with a fake ID. And so, you know, he'd go slamming out of there and, you know, having a fit. We didn't know if he was going to come back or not. It was very stressful. I mean, it really negatively impacted Henning for a long time, maybe still, in terms of how that all went down. Because there was some fallout afterwards. But at the time, like, he would fight us on stuff all the time. We're like, here, just sing this. And it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense. And he's saying it, and he'd come into the control room and we'd play it back, and he'd hands would go up to his head. He's like, oh my God, Mother Truckers, I sound awesome. You know, his wife came out and she was listening, and you have made him sound better than he has ever sounded. Like, there were tears in their eyes listening to the song in an empty room, because it was so powerful. And, you know, the guy, he had a good voice. You know, he takes the singing seriously, and he warms up and does all that. I mean, LaBrie was an insane professional. Like 2 weeks, I think he took one day off, recorded like 18 songs for two albums, singing for like 8 to 10 hours a day, and just consuming unbelievable amounts of water. But that guy's work ethic is just off the hook. And I think there was only one time where he was, I don't know, probably just tired or whatever. And he's like, but he knows himself. He's like, hey, you know what, guys, give me 20 minutes to take a walk. And that was like the extent of anything that might have been difficult with him, which was not in any way difficult. He's a fabulous, you know, Bach, on the other hand, you know, pain in the bus.
So would you say temperamental is the best way to classify it?
Yeah, I think you could go down that path. Yeah, you know, basically at the end of every day, drink a bottle of wine and have a giant joint. And, you know, but he waited till the end of the day. And he was very obsessed with writing credits. It was very odd because, like, Celine Dion doesn't have writing credits. You know, as a singer, you don't need writing credits. And, you know, like actors, if they tweak a line here or there to make it flow better, they don't get a writing credit. That's just what you do. Now, if you make an appreciable difference, that's different. So Bach really wanted writing credits, and he would be changing things up just for the hell of it. And a couple of things he did made a lot of sense, and we gave him writing credits on it. I mean, it's irrelevant. There was no money involved in it. I didn't have an agreement with him for mechanicals or anything like that, and I don't think we ever, you know, received mechanicals. That's not where the money was, because that would have been off of AirPlay.
Yeah.
So not long after that, the guitarist in his band, Ralph, contacts me, and, you know, rest his soul, he passed away suddenly a couple years ago. And, you know, so I probably shouldn't say too much because he can't confirm or deny, but he had contacted me and said that, you know, Bach had contacted him when we sent it and asked him to help him do stuff. He's like, this stuff's great. You need to help me do stuff so I can get writing credits on it.
That's crazy.
And like I say, it was a very weird thing, and it was very juvenile about the whole thing. So we ended up shortly after all that doing the album Credit Where Credit Is Due with Juan Roos on vocal, and wrote and recorded it in 2 weeks. And pretty much everything on there is an inside dig at Bach.
You're joking.
So we've got a reference in there to the person who invented the stapler, for example.
Oh, yeah, man.
One of the songs is called German Metalhead because Bach was working on his solo album, and one of the songs is going to be called American Metalhead. Yeah. So we did that first.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of fans, a lot of listeners don't know of any of this crap going on in the background. It just sounds like hard work working with Sebastian.
I mean, it was 15, 16 years ago, right? Now, we actually contacted VH1 with a pitch because Bach had been making so much noise about this. We said, do a reality show, put us in a studio over a weekend and put him in a studio over a weekend and see who can produce songs in the style of Frameshift. Done. And they thought about it. They didn't bite. But not long after that, ended up being the reality show with Bach, Ted Nugent. And that was and everybody, I'm sure, will deny it, but they did it after we pitched the idea to them.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty damn sure they got it from us.
Wow.
I don't know. I mean, there are two more Frameshift albums that are written and recorded. They were just never released because there's no money in it. So those are just sitting on a hard drive.
What, with other vocalists or Sebastian?
Yeah, with other vocalists.
Oh, wow.
Because after we did it, we're like, okay, so Frameshift is like this concept. It'll be a different, you know, a different topic for each album, and it will be, you know, a different singer.
Looking back, though, would you have done anything different?
Anyway, I mean, the only thing we really could have done differently was gotten a different singer, you know, and you know, the only, you're paying for these guys for a couple of reasons. And I would have people coming to me all the time saying, hey, we can get John Anderson to sing part of this one song for $5,000. Like, dude, nobody's buying your album because John Anderson sang on one album. Nobody is completist anymore. And anybody that guests all over the place basically has no value in terms of sales. Having a 24-page booklet in your CD and doubling the cost of it results in exactly zero extra sales. And these were things that I learned. You know, you have to have awareness and availability for a release. One without the other doesn't do any good. And people keep wanting to put all this money in things that were irrelevant. We had one act get Adrian Belew to add guitar to their whole album. And frankly, I don't think it made it better. So you got to think, is this somebody that you really like? Like, we had Nick DiVirgilio play drums on Amarin's Plight. I love Nick. I love the way he plays drums. Guy's fabulous. And he did a great job. And that was a big part of why we wanted him on. It was because we loved how he played drums. You know? And like, I had Mark Zonder. I mean, you're a drummer. You get it. And I had Mark Zonder play drums on some of my material because I love how Mark Zonder plays drums. The guy can do anything. You know, so there's guys that you get, maybe they're famous or what have you, but it's because you like them. Like, I love Sammy Hagar's voice. I don't need Sammy Hagar. I'd love to get him to sing on some stuff, but I don't need Sammy Hagar to do it. I just like that kind of voice. So if I can find somebody who sings like that, then I would use them. So I guess anyway, my point was, you know, if you're looking for a good performance or if you're getting somebody because they have a name because you think they'll bring you sales, the name thing doesn't matter anymore. You know, getting Steve Hackett to play one solo on your album, nobody's buying it because of that.
So Sean, why did Prog Rock Records end? What ultimately killed it? You know, why do we not now have, you know, Prog Rock Records? Why hasn't it continued and, you know, flourished like it should have?
Yeah, so I had started digital distribution. I was the first one to use Ogg Vorbis. I was the first one of anybody, including iTunes, to do CD quality using FLAC. I came out during the first year or so that iTunes was available. And, you know, I was toying with streaming at the time. You know, I had a good catalog. It was making good money every month. And, you know, it was a lot of independent artists and, you know, a lot of deals were going on. There was platforms coming and going constantly, but a couple of things happened. The server I was running everything on was one that I built, and I had a hardware RAID array in there, but I had two drives go down simultaneously. I still have the whole system sitting under my desk here. Oh my God, I researched so much how to do this to bring it back. And basically there was one chance. And if it got screwed up, that was it. And so we never tried it. Ultimately. But other things that happened, there was an artist for one band that decided to sue us for $1 trillion. The band didn't want him to do it. He got it in his head somehow that we had sold 100,000 copies of the album and we were hiding the sales. It's like, just go run a sound scan if you want. Like, you know, I ran up, I don't know, $50,000 in legal bills. He went through like five attorneys. They kept dropping him because he didn't have a case. And it turned out made a secondary living suing people frivolously. And yeah, the band kept trying to stop him, but then they wouldn't help me anymore because they were afraid he was going to sue them. I'm not going to mention the names or anything because he might try to sue me again. So ultimately with that, my attorney, after a long time, he's like, you know what? You're going to have to just file for bankruptcy. I didn't want to do it. I fought it for the longest time. But because of how I'd set up my companies, my software company was the corporation. Everything else was a DBA under the corporation, and he sued it all. So I had to shut down everything. I mean, you want to talk about being gutted. It, you know, it was everything I had spent my life building for a decade or more. And, you know, like a year later, so in the process of all that, you know, I end up getting a divorce, and, you know, the issues with my ex are sort of legion, and I lost a lot of will to do a lot of things. And, you know, I just kind of was keeping a little bit of a shell going, because, I mean, I had tens of thousands of CDs in my garage, most of which have now been thrown away. I mean, it just made me sick to do it. But, you know, I've still got some, and, you know, we still get orders every month. You know, it's small. I might ship 50 CDs a month. But, you know, as long as there's some people buying them, you know, I'll fulfill them. But I was never able to revive the digital service. And I sold off the radio station to the people who have progrock.com now, Mark Monforti and his wife. So that was, you know, that was kind of what happened there. It was a tragedy. But frankly, at the same time, you know, piracy was a problem, a big, big growing, you know, problem between torrents and just blogs downloading everything. It was getting worse and worse. You couldn't sell anything. When I started, I could sell 3,000 to 5,000 copies of any unknown artist, pretty much, you know, like 2 to 4. And then it got down to where I was lucky to sell 500. So, you know, what are you going to do? You know, it costs money to do all those things. And, you know, I love all the people who think they know better. It's like, well, walk a mile in my shoe and see what's involved. You know, I'm personally out tens of thousands of dollars for having run the label. And there's still a couple of fucktards, you know, running around saying shit about me. It's like, you know, fuck you. It's just like, you know, I sweated blood over trying to keep things going and getting people money, you know, and, you know, honoring all those obligations, you know, but I am personally out an unbelievable amount of money.
So, Sean, what are you up to now? Are you still actively, are you still active in the entertainment space, in the recording space? Are you writing songs, you know, recording songs? What are you currently, you know, doing, you know?
Well, I'm very slowly recording another album. It'll probably be the last one I do, but it's more groove oriented. I just finished a new single. I'm getting loaded up on for digital distribution. It should be released in, I don't know, sometime in December. But it's kind of a Talking Heads meets Gary Numan thing with a groovy beat to it. Maybe I'll send you an MP3 after we finish and check it out. And I mean, my day job, like I say, I've been doing computer stuff since I was 15. So I've always kept doing it. I, you know, would freelance when I wasn't doing my computer stuff. So I've had regular jobs, I don't know, last three and a half years. So I did a lot of work in blockchain and in gaming. I've worked in cannabis and healthcare, and I'm working in the big data space right now with data lakes and analytics and these kinds of things. So I'm a technical writer as well. I've got over 400 published articles. I used to write for magazines, and I do just, you know, freelance and thought pieces now periodically. I started a new place a few months ago, and probably the nicest place I've ever worked at in my life, and, you know, 40 years of professional experience.
Now, Sean, because we've only got a couple of minutes left, you've also dabbled in, if you like, a political career, haven't you? I mean, you've run for council.
Yeah, so I ran for city council a couple of times. I didn't run last time. So when was that, a year ago? So I ran 3 years ago and 5 years ago. Raised a lot of issues. I got a good amount of votes. We have an entrenched political system in town that's been in charge since we were founded in 2000. And I've uncovered a lot of grift going on, and by shining lights at it and getting a lot of community involvement, because it's a quiet and safe town. And so, you know, people just don't notice that things are happening. And there was a lot, and the entrenched power structure counted on that. And nobody paid attention. So they get, I mean, they've gone so far as the mayor has personally libeled me on the dais at city council and multiple times. I mean, he went so far, the local paper that I write for, where I was exposing the stuff and they loved it, he called and threatened them to get them to stop publishing me, but I already publish on a bunch of other things. So it really pisses him off. And I really let him have it. So I've got a watchdog page on Facebook where I keep posting this stuff. I get into his campaign finance stuff and put that out there. And he really doesn't like it. I wasn't involved in this one. There's another group that filed a campaign finance violation on him, and he got nailed for that. And I filed one against his compatriot on the council. And she just gave me this snotty ass answer. And it turned out she did have a violation. She had to fix it. And her response to the state was like, well, you know, he's a two-time failed city council candidate. What does that have to do with anything? You fraudulently filed your campaign finance paperwork, you know, bitch.
So. Well, that was our chat with Sean Gordon of, well, what was Prog Rock Records. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. We have one more episode lined up for this year before we move into 2022. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, and we will chat soon.